Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. I'm Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. Today, we are honored to have David Coates with us. He's the author of a wonderful book called Red List, MI5 and British Intellectuals in the 20th Century, which was recently published by Verso Publishers. David, welcome to New Books Network. David, can you please tell us how did this book come about?
The book came about because it's a follow-up to a book I published in 1978 about the American witch hunts, which was called The Great Fear. That's a long time ago, and I've done a lot of different work in between. But it came back to me when I saw that MI5's files were being released to the National Archive in London. It came back to me that I ought to have a look and see what we could find about the situation in Britain. And indeed, that's what I did.
And thank you. And in the book, you mentioned another historian, Christopher Andrew, and you sort of disagree with Christopher Andrew because he states that MI5 clearly separated issues of national security from party politics, whereas you disagree with him. Can you expand on that point, please?
Yes. It was impossible to dissociate MI5's pursuit of different intellectuals from the question of party politics, because MI5 had its eye mainly on the Communist Party of Great Britain, but also on all left-wing parties which had a passing relationship or collaboration with the Communist Party. And also the second thing is that the bias of Christopher Andrew's history of MI5 is very clear. And Andrew clearly sympathized with the main thrust of MI5's investigations of individual intellectuals. So that's my answer.
And MI5, I was wondering, because in the first chapter of the book, you do talk about how MI5 evolved. So can you talk about the origins of MI5 and since when did they become obsessed with Russian Revolution and the so-called communists in England?
Yes, MI5 began in, I think, 1909 as a small intelligence service to investigate mainly German threats to British security, because there was a kind of Cold War growing up and a hot war between Britain and Germany. But during the war, during the First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution took place, much to the disadvantage of the British, because the Bolsheviks were withdrawing from their military alliance with Britain and France. And so within MI5, hostility grew towards the Bolshevik Revolution. But it was also the case that the Bolshevik Revolution was, so to speak, communist and Bolshevik. And the main personnel in MI5 and their emissaries in Russia deeply disapproved of this left-wing bias, this communist bias. So by the time that the British Communist Party was formed in 1920, MI5 regarded it as the main enemy, the main danger to British security, Germany having been defeated.
And in England, there was also a British Communist Party in 1920s after the Bolshevik Revolution. British Communist Party became the main target of MI5. So did MI5 really have any substantial suspect, or was it just paranoia, or did they really have any evidence that the British Communist Party was a danger to national security?
Well, you can divide that question. First of all, the British Communist Party was founded by Lenin and the Comintern, with the Comintern being the Communist International. And the British Communist Party, they're very small, had devoted allegiance to the Comintern and was completely hostile to British military intervention in Russia, which, as you may remember, took place on the side of the White Armies in Russia. But on the other hand, the British Communist Party was so small that it hardly posed a threat to British security. And MI5 continued to believe that it did. And I've quoted Isaac Deutscher on whether the Soviet Communist Party was intent on overthrowing capitalism in Britain or not, and I came to the conclusion that it was not.
Yeah, thank you. You actually answered my next question, because I wanted to read the quote on page 37 about this, but you just addressed that. Thank you very much, then. Yeah. An important part of the book, which really fascinated me, was about the role of BBC in and also MI5. So you do mention in the book that they sort of were like a semi-official, maybe part of MI5. I mean, they kind of helped MI5 in suppressing the intellectuals or not giving voice to them. So can you talk about the role of BBC and MI5? How did they work? And what was their method of leaning rather than stifling? That's what you have on page 256 of the book.
Well, the problem of the BBC and MI5 is complicated by the passage of time. The BBC was founded in 1922 and didn't pay very much attention to the preoccupations of MI5. But by the time of the Cold War, which is after 1945, the BBC was very much under the sway of MI5 regarding who was appointed to positions in MI5, in the BBC, I beg your pardon, and what particular speakers could be allowed to lecture or talk on the BBC. And the BBC, with regard to a number of people like J.B. Priestley and later a host of communist historians in Britain, and then later to a host of artists and writers and dramatists in Britain, the BBC had its man who was appointed by MI5 to prevent people who were thought to be subversive, which meant in fact that they were rather left-wing, from actually broadcasting. And my book gives a lot of detail about how MI5 intervened to prevent leading historians and scientists and so on from talking on the airwaves.
Mm-hmm. And another fascinating part of your book is about the labor movement or the labor left in and MI5. And we had the prime minister back then in England, Harold Wilson. Did MI5 actually have any fight on Harold Wilson? And I guess in the book you also state that Hal Wilson talks about suspicious, let's say, burglars in his place, because that was also one of the techniques that MI5 used to spy on intellectuals or anybody they deemed to be a risk to Britain.
Well, the case of Harold Wilson, who came to power in 1964 and stayed in power till 1970, Then he came back in 1974 briefly. The case of Harold Wilson is peculiar because he's the first British Prime Minister who seriously came under suspicion from MI5 as being connected to Russian agents. Wilson was extremely indignant when he discovered that a file had been opened on him, and that file was hidden. So I've never seen it. But that's the case of Harold Wilson. I don't think it applies to any other British Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm. And do you see any parallels between this and also the way the Labour Party treated Jeremy Corbyn and the accusations of anti-Semitism against him?
I don't think there's any connection with accusations of anti-Semitism. And I think, since you've raised that subject, but it's outside the scope of my book chronologically completely, I think that what was called anti-Semitism was more often anti-Zionism, which was, I think, the essence of the trouble within the Labour Party.
And let's talk about some famous historians who came under MI5 surveillance. You mentioned a lot of them, but two of the most famous ones are E.P. Thompson and Hobsbawm. So can you talk about this? So what was it that kind of made MI5 suspicious of them? How did MI5, keep an eye on them?
Well, I mean, to begin with, both Hobsbawm and Thompson, who was a younger man than Hobsbawm, were members of the Communist Party and of the Communist Party's historians group, which was extremely influential and quite talented. So it wasn't difficult for MI5 to pick up that connection. In Hobsbawm's case, we find that when he graduated from Cambridge in, I think, 1940, at the beginning of the Second World War, we find that although he was linguistically immensely talented, that MI5 prevented his appointment to any job or post to do with intelligence. So he remained an ordinary soldier, then a sergeant, connected perhaps with the education corps, but then he would put up wall posters saying there should be a second front in Europe, and commanding officers of his regiment, of his unit, sent in to MI5 or military intelligence reports against him. Thompson was a very left-wing Marxist historian who wrote the famous book, The Making of the English Working Class. And he was very active politically, and he wrote many letters to comrades, which were intercepted, as were Hobsbawm's. Remember that MI5 not only intercepted telephone conversations, but letters as well. And Thompson was constantly under surveillance until he rebelled at the time of the Hungarian Revolution, 1956, and left the Communist Party.
Another chapter of your book, which I found fascinating, was about Black liberation and Africanist. An interesting part is that you also talk about some American activists. So can you talk about the role of maybe racial prejudice in this anti-intellectual hysteria in MI5? You talk about, for example, C.L.R. James, Paul Robeson.
Yes. The thing is that MI5, which reflected the general outlook of the British establishment, was very hostile to any colonial, anti-colonial movement, whether in India or West Africa. And so they were not only prejudiced a bit about people's color, but they jumped on characters like Paul Robeson and C.L.R. James, who were in favor of Black liberation in the British colonies. And Robeson, of course, was a bête noire of the FBI and of the House Un-American Activities Committee, because he was pro-Russian. He was very pro-Russian, pro-Soviet, pro-Stalin. And so the British and American intelligence services combined information to be very hostile to Robeson, who lost his passport and couldn't travel, his American passport.
Yeah, and he did travel to Russia on a couple of occasions, I guess. He was invited there by the Russians.
Yes.
And one thing I like about this book is that you talk about authors, you talk about historians. It's also, and one thing I found really surprising was that it was even scientists who came under the suspicion of MI5. Can you talk about that? Why was it that even scientists in 1930s became target for MI5? And who were some of these famous scientists?
Well, the famous scientists are mainly J.D. Bernal, Francis Needham, and Blackett. So the problem was that the scientists as a whole were very pro-Soviet in the 1930s. They thought that what was going on in Russia was a revolution of the intelligentsia rather than the working class, and that Russia was going to be a planned scientific society free of the chaos which was prevailing during the Great Depression in Britain. But also, some of these scientists were highly skilled in matters to do with war, so that when the war against Hitler came along, they were employed in very senior positions for research and advice. And MI5 noticed this very strongly and was constantly warning the military that these people could be dangerous, could have double allegiance. And that applied to Bernal, to Blackett. Blackett was against the British atomic bomb, and that got him in hot water. Needham was pro-Chinese communist, and that got him in hot water. And during the Korean War, when it was alleged that the Americans had used germ warfare, Needham joined a group of scientists who generally broadly endorsed that as true. So Needham was persona non grata in America. That was the general fact, that a large number, like Dorothy Hodgkin, and a large number of scientists were generally pro-Soviet. And MI5 knew that and followed them very closely.
I come from a literary background, therefore writers are kind of like my passion and in the book. And I was, when I came across the book, I was looking for George Orwell and his notorious list, because he also put together a list of those intellectuals who sympathized with the Soviets. So, but he was also under suspicion from MI5. Can you talk about maybe some of the ways that MI5 scrutinized writers, specifically George Orwell?
Well, some reviewers of my book, Red List, have made the mistake of not looking at the right index and have complained that Orwell is not in the index, but he is. He's in the index of victims. And in that, you'll find the pages where, since 1930, he's been reported on as a left-wing pro-communist, even when he was in living in France. He was a contributor to the Left Book Review and left books in general, but he became quite anti-communist, quite strongly anti-communist, by the time of the Second World War. And there's a famous incident which you've just mentioned, when he was very ill in 1949 with tuberculosis, in effect dying, and he had a female friend who had joined the Independent Research Department of the Foreign Office, which was a kind of MI5. And he sent her a list of people who he called fellow travelers, who might be a danger to British security and who might be subversive. And that list has become notorious, although it was actually never used.
Thank you for explaining this. And one fascinating case you talk about your book, you discuss in your book, is Claire Sheridan, who is Winston Churchill's cousin. And apparently there was this episode of, even despite being Churchill's cousin, Claire was also a suspect. And there was an episode of sexual harassment or accusation of sexual harassment from Mussolini. I'm sure our listeners will find it fascinating if you explain that.
Well, you're in a very different period there. Claire Sheridan crops up in from 1920, right at the beginning. And she was a sculptor. And she did a number of distinguished British politicians and statesmen. And her sculpture was much admired. Then she decided in 1920 to go to Russia to do models of the Soviet leaders like Trotsky and Lenin and Zinoviev and so on. And she did, and she had a very hard time. She was an aristocrat from a good from a good background, and when I say good, I mean a comfortable, wealthy background. And she found life in Russia very hard indeed in 1920-21. But she pulled off some marvelous sculptures, and MI5 knew all about that. And but they regarded her as a bit of a joke. I mean, she became a prolific journalist, but worked for American newspapers, but nobody took her terribly seriously in political terms, though she was a very good sculptor.
And can you broadly tell us about some of the techniques that MI5 used against to kind of, you know, control or keep an eye on intellectuals, right? As you talk about, for example, the staged burglaries, I'm sure they intercepted their correspondence as well. What were some of the common techniques that MI5 used against intellectuals?
Well, the common techniques were, first of all, informers within a particular organization, and they were very clever at planting people who appeared to be communists, appear to be left-wing, and to gain the trust of communist colleagues and so on, but reported relentlessly to MI5, who put it all in the file. Another technique, which I've mentioned, was intercepting letters. And MI5 had the General Post Office at its disposal for steaming open letters. Then the bugging of telephones was very common, particularly Communist Party headquarters in King Street, Covent Garden, was constantly bugged. And they used the special branch of the Metropolitan Police, which is the London Police, to follow people. The special branch did most of the following on foot, or however, and they reported to MI5 the whole time. And within the special branch, whose members were not always, shall we say, highly enlightened or educated, you get the anti-Semitism and the anti-racism and the anti-black prejudice coming through, which the better educated officers of MI5, who basically in the early years came from the colonial service or the military and had those sort of right-wing opinions, they didn't necessarily accept the racial aspect of it.
And in all this obsession of MI5 with intellectuals, because you cover a vast period, you cover a lot of different intellectuals, scientists, did you find any really substantial evidence that they were really a threat, or do you think it was part of a general, you know, Cold War hysteria, maybe, of being obsessed with intellectuals?
Well, but the basis of the book is that there was very little foundation to any suspicion of subversion by intellectuals. The prejudice of MI5 for almost a whole century was that anyone who had any connection with any organization which had any connection with the Soviet Communist Party must be suspect and likely subversive. And that carried through to organizations like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, in the later years, and huge hostility towards the National Council for Civil Liberties, which was occasionally had a bit of communist influence, but not very much. It was basically a liberal organization. So have I answered your question on that?
Yes, I have. And as a last question to bring this interview to an end, I'm going to ask a hypothetical question because I'm interested in your idea as a historian. Do you think still in 21st century, the British intelligence service is still maybe with more subtle techniques is suspicious or keeping an eye on intellectuals, writers, people who might be against the mainstream politics of in England?
Well, of course, the Soviet Empire collapsed in, I think, 1989, 1990. And at first, it seemed that the so-called Soviet danger had gone away and relationships diplomatically with Russia improved. They're obviously very bad again now with the war in the Ukraine. But basically, the thing to remember is that the pursuit of communists and fellow travelers and similar sympathizers with the Soviet Union ceased to be the main occupation of MI5 after about 1990. And the attention of MI5 turned to other threats to British security, like various Middle Eastern, like Al-Qaeda, terrorist organizations, and sympathy for them amongst say, Muslims living in Britain, so that what MI5 had to do was to change its clothes and its attitude, and there were no great space for old colonels and old colonial district officers. It was now you needed informers from within the British Muslim communities, people who spoke the local language and could appear to be in favor of Muslim movements or anti-imperial movements or anti-American movements. That became the other thing that MI5 had to do was to deal with Republican terrorism in Ireland. And there again, there was this huge recruitment of Irish or Ulster personnel who could appear to be sympathetic towards the terrorist movements like the IRA. So that was again a huge switch of influence. But I haven't seen, because they're not available and they're not part of my subject, any of the files on those people.
David, I cannot thank you enough for your time and for talking about this fascinating book. Thank you very, very much.
It's a pleasure.